This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are on location with Greg McBride. He's the founder and publisher of Innisfree Poetry Journal. But more than that, he's a poet. And here he is. Here's Greg McBride.
Hi, Grace. Thank you very much for having me.
Love to hear an opening poem.
Okay. This is this new book is called Guest of Time, a memoir and poem. So I thought I would just kind of go through sequentially. And I thought the poem on page 10, The Table, might be a good way to start. I was a young boy at this point, maybe a fourth grader or something like that. And this is called The Table. $10 at the old stuff shop. All of us together then on the kitchen floor. Our captain father disassembling top from base. Base from splayed claw feet. They fixed and stripped week by week. Our mother cross-legged on the tile. Rootling toothpicks at the crannies. The squawk and scree of aged oak accented our father's hums and cusses until, with rising satisfaction, he began to whistle, "Begin the Begin." He reassembled, made it tight, and the metronomic rasp of his sander unearthed a wash of woody forest scent from the flesh of fresh-cut trees. I could not get enough of it. All of us together then. Around the salvaged table.
Greg McBride, that poem is from a book called The Guest of Time, a memoir and poems. When we finish reading that book, what do we know that Greg McBride cares about?
You're asking me.
Yeah. What do we find? What do we know about your life? But more than that, what do we know about what really matters to you from these poems?
Gosh, I know hardly how to...
I would say family. Well, actually, yeah. Let me just say, I'm going to give you a prompt. Because okay. When I give you a resume, it's going to answer your question. Because it's in the book. And you were an Army brat. You were a state wrestling champion for Pennsylvania. An Army photographer in the Vietnam War. A public service lawyer in D.C., father, grandfather, husband. It's all here. Civic activist. It's all here. Everything you love, Greg.
I've been a busy guy.
Yeah, and you have memorialized it and made it all permanent in this book, which is a scrapbook of your heart, really. You've had a big life.
It has been a big life, and I turned to poetry when I was about 60, and I found that the poems that came naturally grew out of my life experience. My family's history is a difficult one, and I was always temperamentally somewhat reserved and calm, and not a naughty kid by any means. I was quite the opposite, and yet, while a total non-combatant, I never got in a fight in my childhood life. But somehow got roped into wrestling, and here I am, this exercise that I wasn't temperamentally cut out for, but it turned out I was quite cut out for it athletically. Mm-hmm. And I had the same experience with the Army. My father was drafted in World War II and then stayed in. And he was just from a tiny town in Idaho and was drafted at very young. And during World War II, he never went to the war, but he was in it and stayed in for a career and went all the way from private to full colonel without a college degree. So it was quite a life he had. So I've written a prose memoir that I call Wrestling with My Father, because there was a lot of drama involved there.
That brings us to another poem. So let's go to your next poem, because I think your father figures in that one as well.
He does. Yeah, that's Treasure. Get a little water. I'm in speech therapy, by the way, so I have to keep hydrated.
Oh, that's very interesting.
treasure. My mother sent me out for milk. 2 blocks right, she said. 1 left. First time by myself. I skipped and jumped, avoiding cracks. Fiddled pocketed marbles all the way. At the market, a gray man on the bench, dog tags dangling from a leathered neck. Unshaved and gaunt, in a drooping brown suit, he offered cupped hands to me. A heap of silver eagles, nickel buffalo, silver lady dollars sparkling in the sun. He stared at me, wet mouth, wheezy and open, 1 gold tooth which glinted like coins as he thrust his hands up and up to me. I stepped away, near an edge, the man too eager, oddly friendly, man of no words. I mumbled, "No, thank you," exhaled regret. Halfway home, the glass milk bottle grown heavy, I sat and leaned back against a tree and thought about the gray man, whether he had a son with gold teeth, and why he wouldn't give his treasure to that son, and why he wasn't off to work that morning like my father, whose pocket change jangled up the walk home late afternoons, his jaunty stride and shiny shoes, coins left on the bureau I could find and rifle through.
You know, Greg, your poems about your father are very positive. And I'm very interested in the father-son relationship in literature. It's a very powerful theme throughout time. So how does your relationship with your father affect your writing?
Very considerably, I think. My dad was an extreme extrovert. My mother, on the other hand, was an extreme introvert. And I'm obviously a blend of them both, but I'm far closer to the introvert than my father was just quite a force, quite a character. And he kind of didn't know what to do with me. He was also an athlete, but he was very mechanical and could fix anything. I was totally uninterested in mechanical things. You know, I wanted to read. I wanted to play games. Yeah. We just weren't on the same wavelength. And he came of a generation, he was born in 1920, and he just, he had a hard time figuring out how to relate to me.
So do you think you had a relationship?
Well, from the time I was 13 forward, he did not seem to like me very much.
But the interesting thing is that your poems are favorable to an extent, and I think you've made peace with him through poetry.
Yes, and in writing the prose memoir as well. What I was doing with that was trying to figure out what happened in my birth family that was kind of catastrophic for me, as it turned out. And my mother and I were very close, but my mother was a victim of the suppression of women in the 40s, 50s, 60s. She didn't make it, became depressed and alcoholic. And my father, who had been brought up a Mormon in Idaho, could not tolerate that. And there was no help to be had in those days. And so I wanted to get at what happened. And I, in the course of writing the prose piece, I think I came to peace with my father. And he was a wonderful guy. He just wasn't a great at fathering.
But, you know, there's an honoring that you do in your writing, which I think evens the score very well. And I would love you to read another poem from your book.
Okay.
Showing up here, terrific, terrific, if everyone can see that. Tell us about the cover.
Well, this was in this would have been in the January of 1948 or 1948, and my father had been sent to Japan as part of the occupation force, and so my mother and I and my 3-month-old sister got on this troop ship in San Francisco. We sailed to Alaska and then from Alaska to Yokohama. And this is a picture of us out on the deck.
Yeah, the pictures, people should get the book. The pictures are really heart stirring. So let's proceed.
Okay. So I was going to read you a poem that came from my wrestling days called Whistled Alive. Late fall, the world again closing in upon itself. Nights extend, days stall, and the chill takes hold of Pennsylvania. We hibernate under artificial light in the practice room where wrestling coaches bark enduring truths, then whistle us alive in this rite reserved for the strong, the quick, the sinewy, light, doggedly wary. This must be some kind of love, this shutting out, shutting in, this drain of self into self, more weight to shoulder through our hunger. We shuffle and tender sugar feet. He's a mirror me. I claw, he claws, heads butt, hands seize sweat slick muscle. I collar him, rough a forearm hard to his clavicle, stutter step, balance, balance is all. I am stronger, faster. So say tight grips, the hurried brawl. I flash to a leg, he drops to splay his weight over me. The way soggy nautical rope might feel, knotty, tentacular, doughy. He grabs my head, wheels on the axis he makes of me. His strength meets mine. I parry his every move, each the other reified. The mild sorrow of blood rises warm in my mouth. He's on his back. I power down, but he rears unstoppably from the mat. Sudden loss, sudden win. We practice both, again, again. No winner here. It's him, myself, I pin.
Wow, Pennsylvania State Wrestling Champion. Go on to the next poem, because I want to talk about both of them together.
Okay. The next poem I was going to read was the first of the Vietnam poems. And you would ask me about energy in a poem, and this poem is about the act of leaving home to go to war. And as a matter of fact, I had written a poem in my first book on the exact same issue, leaving home to go to the war. This one's called The Home Front. He pumped his fist toward the arcing sky of National Airport. Another diminutive, desk-bound patent exhorting another soldier's son to war, playing a role, a screen-bound Cagney, reality smoldering at home. My mother pleated her lips. Her hand trembled, a wave slowed by denial, then sunk by the weight of despair. Once aboard, I thought of them at home. He to bed early with Churchill and Twain. She in the den with Saturday Review, drinking the hours, anesthetized into the next afternoon. Then the long worry over the Pacific, avoiding the fitful eyes of others, as the passage from family to war passed in a dazzle. The way a mortar shell streaks through the long lull between barrel burst and the shuttered rending of somebody's home.
What struck me in reading your book and these two poems was the physical act of wrestling, which was pitting yourself against another force. And then the struggle and the pitting of the forces in the next poem. It's as if one is very physical, but the next is very emotional, where your whole family was wrestling. It was like a struggle. So there's so much struggle that you untangle in your work to make it clear. And I'm very touched by that struggle, because these two poems epitomize it very much. And I think that's where the energy in poetry might be. the struggle.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. The energy in poems. You know, I hadn't written a poem until 30 years after I was in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And yet, one of the first subjects of those poems was my experience in Vietnam. And I think they reflect the intensity of that experience, which stays with you. I'm writing fewer of those now, but I wrote quite a few of them there for a while.
And they are time-honored poems. So continue then and give us a taste of that.
Okay. The next poem. My job in Vietnam, I was a second lieutenant at age 23 when I went over, and I was chief of the Army's medical photography team. It was an amazing job. My boss was back in Washington, and I was turned loose.
But you weren't. But you were a trained photographer.
No, okay. I was not.
And a trained medic.
No.
Okay, so you put those together, and you became the head of photography for the medical team. Okay,
exactly.
Well, tell us more.
After Army Basic, I went to Walter Reed for some training. And we were mostly shooting video. But so I had six men working for me, photographers and jeeps and blanket travel orders. And we were all over the country. And I'd send one group to this hospital. I'd take another to this or this field. It was an amazing adventure. And I've written at length about that. But this is a snapshot of that experience called Army Photographer. Research dermatologist. Rice fields washed and bent in the choppered ruckus, the delta fleeting beneath our boots. We slowed into the settling of our own din, onto the clearing, the sandbagged base camp, like a Hollywood set. The scene morose with soldiers who littered scrubby flatroom. We were REMFs, sons of bitches, come to survey how they might survive. Doc asked one soldier how many days he'd slogged through paddies, slept wet in fatigues and socks, how many leeches he'd burned from his crotch. Doc turned to the sole and heel and toes of a kaleidoscopic foot, its welter of colors. Wow, get a close shot of this. I wrapped in my viewfinder, I marveled at fungal shadows, scattered islands across the arch. The ankle, under nails, the foot bloated, blue currents coursing beneath yellow-purple knolls. Wow, I thought, wow, then snapped.
Fabulous, last line. Greg started writing, he started writing after this career, and I believe your first book came out when you were 67 years of age.
Right.
But it won an award for the first book of poetry, the Liam Rector Award. And then you have The Guest of Time. In between, you've written prose. You're an editor and a publisher. And you have won the Emerging Poetry Prize, Boulevard Emerging. That was a book that won the prize from the Maryland State Arts Council. And you've been published lots of places. So I'll just name a few. Alaska Quarterly, Bellevue, Gettysburg Review. Unfortunately, that just has closed, Greg.
Oh, sadly.
Yeah, New Ohio Review, Rhino, River Styx, Salamagundi. These are such wonderful, familiar journals to me. Tell us more about being an Army photographer. It sounds like it was pretty hard.
Well, it was.
You have to close your heart a lot of times.
The saving grace in that experience is that you have this camera between you and reality, and it does help. It does help. You're engaged in this mechanical aesthetic process, regardless what is before you, and you have to focus on that at the same time you're focusing on what's happening before you. And it was hard, but I'm surprised because I saw death so often and terribly wounded young men so often I'm surprised that I've never felt that I suffered from any PTSD over it. In fact, there's a funny thing that happened to me. I had insomnia during my college years, just from the stress of being off to college. And I got to Vietnam, and within a week or two, I was sleeping like a baby. And it was a funny thing.
We call it exhaustion.
Maybe so. Maybe so. Also, some fatalism in there, I think, because you kind of think that if I'm killed, it's probably going to be quick.
So you release. You just release.
You go on. Yes, you have a. And I got excited about this job I had, which was a fantastic job.
What happened to the photos?
Well, they're all in the archives. The films were the reason we were filming these things is that you see things in war you will not see in any big city of America. The kind of injuries that soldiers suffer are just beyond imagining. Where was I going with that?
Well, you've gone the right place, and I'll tell you, it is that you surrendered to your job.
And yes,
I think of my husband landing on the carrier 1,000 times in the dark. I think he had to go on autopilot. You just become a robot to get through it, and yet you don't. Then your compassion comes back, and as you say, it has manifested in poetry with you. With Ken, it went into sculpture, and that's how he healed himself. But let's have another poem from this book, which everyone really would benefit from getting, called Guest of Time by Greg McBride. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're going to hear another poem.
Okay. This one is about my mother, who came from a tiny town in the middle of Central Texas. Earlene was her name. She looks out from the 40s photograph in the ostentatious health of a Southern girl with the toothsome smile of Miss America, filling her blouse, a hand-me-down from Sister Billy Doris, maybe Maxine. Her brunette dew gleams, a full skirt cinches her waist, and a careful hand, slight at her face, frames one lazy down eye, a sweetheart wink in the heat and dust, far out on the edge of a used-up Texas town. During the war, even the poorest sort of girl in the plainest sort of dress, who posed leaning back against the only tree for miles, could blaze in dry heat like a breeze-rocked apple. The buses carried bib-overalled boys to Camp Bowie, Camp Swift. On three-day pass, sporting white sidewalls, garrison caps raked to one side, they would come and go, base to home, then to Europe or the Pacific, an army that moved in time to Artie Shaw's jukebox clarinet. A sergeant from Idaho caught her eye in Abilene. Short but strong, he sang his own song. They began to begin. She left technical school. 30 years slipped by. God left town for good. Her brother died. Kids weren't the same, even her own, and the world got big until, bewildered, she steered the 68 Plymouth in woozy aim straight at the hardened heart of that lying tree.
There's not a more powerful poem than that one written. And let's have a final poem, Greg.
Well, I have a very good friend I was a college roommate with and also in Vietnam with. And he comes through town and we have dinner together. Been doing this for many, many years. So I have a poem. We were having dinner one night when he was in town, and Death at Dinner came out of that meal. I ordered the trout, he the spare ribs. This man I was a boy with through college and war, asks how I think about death. Now we're in our 70s. I don't think about it much, I say. It's the present. What to do? What to eat? My friend regrets all he'll miss. Isn't that, I say, the human curse, never to be satisfied? And what's worse, to hunger for more so strongly, we feed ourselves a fishy story of afterlife. After coffee, we rise from tufted armchairs, murmuring of our bond, of another departure, of another visit, soon. And as we step out into air gone soggy, into a cold, quiet rain, without a prayer of staying dry, I'm wishing I'd had the poached salmon.
The voice of Greg McBride, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MAT Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation, the Song in the Room Women's Poetry Group, and the Maryland State Arts Council. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.